Hey folks, welcome to episode number 362 of the Ages of Rock podcast. And this week we have singer, songwriter, guitarist, band director, and lead guitarist for the Bret Michaels Band, Pete Evick. How are you doing, Pete?
I'm great, man. How are you guys doing?
Doing pretty good.
Doing all right. A little chilly up here.
We heard a rumor that you've got a book you're wanting to talk about.
My second book, brand new book, came out last month called MTV Famous. Yep.
This is book number two?
Book number two. I wrote another book 6 years ago. But the other book has nothing to do with the music industry. It was more of a inspirational kind of, I was going through a divorce and it became a single dad and it, that took on a whole thing to me and I started writing about it, but then the book became more about just inspiration and life and stuff, but it not much about the music business, but it did really, really well. I was really proud of it. And the reviews were great. And then, but a lot of people wanted me to interject some music into my writing. So that's where MTV Famous comes in.
That's awesome. Like I said, I will, to be honest, I have sped read a lot of your book. No, that's the way I do that. And the thing is, I do not like watching. I got the PDF here a while back.
Yeah.
And I am going to buy the book. So that's at the end of the show or at any point, if you want to say where we can buy this, because I'm going to buy one too. Because I like to have the pages.
There you Amazon's go. Where you get it.
There you go. But no, I've sped read a lot of it. And when something hits me, I did it. I love the book. To be honest, I think it's very well written, number one. And being a person that was in high school, started that band before anybody knew how to really play anything.
Right.
Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. I imagine we're all of similar age. Yeah. And
right.
So if you grew up in that late 70s, early 80s rock scene or just into that stuff, most of that stuff I would have to believe you can relate to almost as if you were writing the stories yourself.
Exactly.
And that was important to me. The important thing about that book and my other book is anyone that reads it, I always try to send the message, no matter who you are, where you're at, we're all alike. Everyone's different, but we're all alike. And that's important. It doesn't, I often say Bret Michaels is almost a billionaire and he flies around in his plane to his nine different houses. But, right now I live in an apartment and he comes to visit me in this apartment and he's just my friend when he's here and I fly on his plane and I'm just his friend and I don't have the money to own a plane. But those kind of things don't matter. The soul, the things you love and the way you grew up is what makes all of us the same, you know?
It does. And then, like I said, when watching or reading about, like I said, your early years of, starting out in bands and like I said, starting out in high school and, and I had the same thing with my dad that you had, as far as the guitars, it was like, I had to actually prove to him that I could play to get a guitar. I had a crappy one.
Yeah. But
you know what? It took me about 3 weeks. And like I said, a Mel Bay's book. And I figured Bay it book. Out. And right. I had a friend of mine that said, hey, you can play. And I learned enough chords to play Ghost Riders in the Sky. And he goes, okay, that guitar you wanted up there was $100. We're going to do it. You got a Les Paul, but I didn't get the Les Paul.
Well, that was certainly a strange event. But it worked. It worked. But I got to tell you, you're talking about Riders in the Sky. Am I right to assume that all three of you guys are giant Kiss fans? All three
that
of
would
you?
Be correct. No,
well,
of course,
they're more giant than I am. I'm only 5'6".
I guess.
We're over six. Oh, we're
I'm
both
six
over
two.
Six.
I'm
foot.
6'2".
Yes,
I'm
we
six
are all
one,
massive Kiss fans.
Just a shorty.
So you guys may get a kick out of the very first performance in my entire life. The very first song I ever performed in front of an audience was "Rip It Out" in my fourth grade talent show.
Nice.
That's really a banger.
Yeah, and he still opens with it. It's a great, when he does his solo stuff, that's still a big part of the night. That Ace Frehley record. Was a game changer for me. That was my life for a long time.
Yep.
Yeah. Look, cool. Looking at your thing, you're probably what you were born, what, 72?
72. Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, was in the book. So like I say, well, I'm 65. So I had a little bit on you. So in 74, you know, I was, you know, when Kiss Alive came out.
Yeah, you were.
I was 7 years old. I was ready to go. I was ready to go at that point.
My my good friend, and he plays, used to be in a Bret Michaels band with me, and he plays in my band, this, that, and the other, Eric Brittingham from Cinderella. He's sure. He's 65 years old. I don't know if that, it blows my mind sometimes that you know, Bret's 60. Sammy Hagar turned 76 last week.
All that.
You mm-hmm. know? And
look at Mick Jagger.
Oh, Jagger. I don't even know how old he is, but it's a
80. Yeah, 80, right?
Is he 80?
He is 80, and Keith Richards will be 80 sometime in the next few weeks.
My favorite memes, I it's so heartless, but when a celebrity dies and then the meme is
the Grim Reaper.
No, it's
Keith Richards. Keith Richards. You outlive everybody.
You. I outlive you. It's amazing, you know. But you know, my point was from that whole age group. Eric's one of my best friends, and he's 65 years old. But we all share. The world didn't move that fast back then, so we all still share a lot of the same memories over a 10-year gap. Of you know, that you could be 10, 12 years older than each other and still. Right. Share a lot of that same thing. It's not like today where what's cool now, by the end of this interview, three things will have been cool and not cool already, you know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I really connected with the comment you made about John Mellencamp. I was a big Mellencamp fan when, you know, Hurt So Good, that record came out, stuff like that. It was I remember riding around, me and my buddies on the way to school, windows down, that just blaring,
right.
You know, it was, well, just,
you know, can I ask you guys, are you're all out in the Midwest then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm 16 closest. Miles from John Mellencamp's home.
Well, and we were probably born. Alan and I are about 2 hours from Mellencamp's home. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I talk about this in the book, I'm born and raised in Washington, D.C. And at our age group, so, and again, I'm a little younger than you guys, we found out, but, you know, when I was growing up, Washington, D.C. was the murder capital of the United States. And, you know, I always make the joke when I'm playing acoustic shows, that was, you know, Chicago and Detroit didn't have shit on us back then. Our mayor did crack, and we let him stay, you know what I mean? And, I was fascinated by those Mellencamp videos, because I wanted to see that part of the world. And I think that probably when you guys were growing up, you wanted to see where I was from, or you wanted to know about New York or LA or DC. And I was the exact opposite. And more than anybody, Mellencamp painted this picture of what I thought America was supposed to be. And I still long for it. We have a joke. I actually posted on my Instagram the other day. Whenever I'm touring, whether it's with Bret or with Eric or with Chad from Faster Pussycat, we were in Indiana and Illinois last week, and I'll point out when we're going by, is that where the Pink Houses video was filmed? It has to be that. And they all like, no, that's not. But it's a joke about us. I'm connected out there to where you guys are big time. And then actually, you mentioned Louisville. I flew into Louisville last Thursday. We played in Corbin, Kentucky, We flew into that airport, and then we went off and played into Effingham, Illinois. We're always out. You mentioned Noblesville. The Bret Michaels Party Girl tour came to the.
Yep, we were there.
Were you there?
Yep, absolutely.
Oh, did you have a good time? Did you get the?
I had a really good time. Yeah.
Did you get there early enough to watch Starship play?
I saw the whole thing. Yeah, we were there really early. We were there. It was the crowd when we got there. I was really nervous because there was nothing. There were.
Oh, yeah.
It was bad. I'm like, oh, my God. And then.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Then thank God it got busier. But man, at the beginning, I was like, oh, my God, this is horrible. Yeah. I always feel bad for the people in the band. I don't feel, oh, yeah. I, you know, I just like, oh, my God.
Yeah, you're like, but, I got room to move around. But
No, I got no. I had the whole damn. I had the whole damn outfield to move around. It was that, really
that happened several nights during the show, and but by the right before we took the stage every night, those places filled up, and you know, if you were there to see Starship, were you not impressed?
I was very impressed. Actually, I don't know her name that did the Grace Slick thing.
He's really good.
They started White Rabbit.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, I looked at my buddy and I'm like, holy shit. Like, you know, I thought I'd never hear that song.
We took a lot of grief for bringing them out on the road with us. But
they're fantastic.
But Brett, that whole tour was to Brett, was he wanted songs. He just wanted songs. And Starship's one of those bands, when they start playing, you go, oh, fuck, I know that song. Oh, I know that song too. And you don't realize, and they do a whole set of incredible material. And that girl, Kathy, she's from Chicago. She's a Midwest girl. And she's friends with Grace Slick. And Grace actually endorses that version of the band as opposed to Mickey Thomas's version of Starship.
Yeah, I saw that his version's going back out.
Yeah,
I saw that.
We played with them a bunch of times too. And
I've seen him, and he's really good. I mean, and he's got a great guy. He's got his backup band's a really great bunch of guys.
Yeah, they're super.
They're two touring bands that are very good, very nice, very good.
But you know, I got to be really close with all those guys in Starship. But when you see them walk out on stage, a couple of them are. I think that the one guy is 80. I think he's 80.
The keyboard player. Yeah.
Yes. And and you walk out and you don't know what to expect, and they killed it every night, man. You know, and then Night Ranger is great every time. You can't see a bad Night Ranger show. So that really put the bar up for us to get out there and have to really, really, really kill it. But that's interesting that you guys were there, man. That's awesome.
Here's a real quick thing. I'm gonna toot my own horn.
Are you kidding me?
So I opened up for John Cougar Mellencamp at Robert Stadium in 2005.
How amazing was that? Other than the fact that I'm going to go on record and say this, I have a lot of friends. I have a lot of friends in the music industry. You're Kiss fans. Me and Ace Frehley text back and forth all the time. Dee Snider is one of my good friends. I have a lot of real friends in the music industry. I've never met Mellencamp, but his own brother told me he's a dick.
Yeah, I'm like...
Oh, do you really want to know?
Yeah, I would love
to hear more.
You just went like this. You opened a can of worms. Yeah, no, I will say that it was for me to play Robert Stadium. That was the biggest stadium. You know, it's the biggest.
Yeah, yeah.
Place in, you know, 10,000 seat venue in our area. To do that, to open up for anybody was amazing. Sure. That was not the person that I wanted to open up for. And I'll leave it at that. And I'll be very nice about it.
How did you get the gig?
So Toyota, I worked for Toyota, and they hired him to come in to be the headliner. And then we had a battle of the bands, and I won the battle of the bands.
Oh, great.
Two of us. I put a band together that hadn't been together in 23 years.
That's awesome.
And we won.
What did you guys play opening for him?
What's that?
What material did you guys play?
Oh, my God. We played Dockin, Fastway. We played two originals, which was just incredible. I got my two originals out in front of that band. We did Sammy Hagar, and we ended up, and then we did AC/DC.
He hates that stuff, too.
Oh, he does. And the thing was that the guys in his band, the black bass player, I can't remember his name, but I ate dinner with him. He was like going, you mofos. He goes, you lived that, didn't you? Because we wore wigs and all this bullshit. We had like the leather on and stuff. And we played it up because it was fun. And, and Cougar come out and he goes, we met him at the end. And he was just very, very disrespectful.
That's how he is to everybody.
And the thing was, is one of the guys in our band actually co-wrote Grandview USA, which is a song that he just put out here within the last 10 years with his brother. And he mentioned the fact that I co-wrote that song. He goes, I could never make that song good, and walked right by him. Yeah, he's
Sounds like everything I've ever heard my whole life.
He is not good.
But the unfortunate truth is he wrote some of the most timeless rock and roll of all time. So I still, when I do my acoustic shows, I play Pink Houses. I play Small Town. I play Hurts So Good. I love it. So
plus you met somebody else from this area, Andy Timmons, that you write very well in your book.
Is Andy from that area?
Andy is from Evansville.
Mm-hmm. Is he really?
Yes, he is. He was in a band around here that played a long time in this area, and that's when he went from there to working with Danger Danger.
Yeah, I've never known that, but man, he's a super nice guy and super great player.
Super nice guy.
He was all those guys. It's funny, he's the only one I don't talk to all the time. I talk to Ted Poley almost every day, and Steve West, and they're great friends, but I don't talk to Andy, but man, well, he made a big impression on me at an early age.
Yeah, Andy comes back here quite a bit, and I know that Tim over at Musicians Inn, he comes in, he gets these collector guitars. He's a big collector.
Yeah, right.
And but no, Andy's a super nice guy. Super cool. Nice guy. I was glad to see that in your book. So
yeah, very much.
So speaking of your book, what was the inspiration for the title MTV Famous? Tell us a little bit about that.
This is my favorite part about interviewing about this book, because I usually pride myself on being able to, I've never taken a lot of heat. Let's just say it that way. There's not a lot of haters out there about the things I do. And when the book came out, there was kind of a backlash online about the title. A lot of people thought that I was claiming to be MTV Famous. And so there was a whole lot of, who this fucking guy think he is? He didn't even have success in the music business during the MTV era. And he's not fucking famous. And I was like, man, and they really beat me up about that, a few people. And the inspiration, the title MTV Famous wasn't even the name of the book until almost the very end, like literally a few days before we released the book. I co-wrote it with a guy named Steve Olivas from Nashville, who is incredible. He owns a publishing company, and he's a great author, and he's also a therapist.
But we know Steve.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Steve's amazing. And so with that being said, the way me and Steve wrote this book was very much like, I would talk to him for a few hours, then he would write it down and send it back to me, and we'd go back and forth. And he kept interjecting the term MTV Famous. And at first it bothered me. I was like, why does he keep saying MTV Famous? And then all of a sudden I realized that's what my life was about, trying to chase the dreams of those people on MTV. I wasn't a radio guy. I was, you know, like I said, I was born in 72, and you know, by the time I was in middle school, MTV was in full force. But the MTV Famous also talks about how when I was a kid, if you were on MTV, I just thought you were rich and famous. And this is what's important. I wasn't chasing. I was too young to care about money or any of the things that the drugs or the girls, none of that mattered to me. It was just the music. That's all that mattered. But it was fascinating to find out to me later in life that all these people that were what I call MTV Famous, some of those people, your video was on MTV and they were still working day jobs at gas stations. And I wasn't aware of that. You just thought they're famous. They were all millionaires because they'd made it to MTV. And it was a real shock to my system as I got older when I found out how the music business really is. You know what I mean? And it's really, really small. You can make it in the music business. I mean, I've had a 36 year career in the music business. I'm here. There's no faking that. I'm here in the business, but I'm not like Brett. I don't have a plane, you know? And, it was eye opening to me to realize that, you know, even, you know, those people had half the people we were watching MTV went home and worked at a gas station or were school teachers, or even Gene Simmons was a teacher, you know that, but you know, so that's kind of what the inspiration behind the title of the book meant.
No. And that's one thing you mentioned in your first thing, when you said to my, I can be a cover artist and make $500, you know, a gig. Yeah. Or I could play my own shit and I could make maybe $20 or something like that.
Right, right. You know,
the thing is, when I started out in 1983, we were making basically it was $100 a guy.
Right.
In a band. But
83, that's great.
But the thing was I got into it again because I quit playing. I got into it again 20 years later. And guess what? I'm making $100 a night.
Brother, I have to tell you. So when I joined Brett's band 20 years ago, I kind of stopped playing locally. I'm back to playing. I play solo acoustic acts. I play with my band Evic. But for 10 years or so, so before I got in Brett's band, we were a top tier cover band in our area, right? And that was, what would have 20 years ago been? 2003. And I was making $1,500 to $1,800 a night, the whole band, right?
Right.
And
for top tier, yeah.
And I'd worked really hard to get there, but it's 20 years later. It's exactly what you just said. And most of the top tier cover bands in my area now are making 800, maybe 1,000. Like, what a disaster. you know what I mean? Yeah. So I relate to what you just said. And I try to champion my area and try to talk to people about this. But, you know, you got a band that'll do it. Once a band will play for that money, then the next guy plays for that money. And then, you know, there's not like, there should be a little more sticking together to say we're worth more money, but not where I live, man. And you went through the same exact thing.
And of course, the problem with that is that you want to make $1,800 a night, but that venue owner knows that there's somebody else that will play for $800 a night or whatever. So, you know, you get what you can take, or you sit at home on the couch and watch Netflix.
We had an owner up there, remember up on 41, that was, you know, he had a venue. He said, well, you know, I'm going to put your name on my digital sign, so that's worth something. But he wanted to pay you less than what, you know, paying. I'm like going, I'm just not going to play that game anymore. And the thing is, you know, when you go on a, you know, when I own the PA, I own the trailer. I was that guy. Yeah, so I owned everything. And nobody was ever chipping in on shit. So if something broke, you know, speaker blew out, I always fixed it. Blah. Alan knows my shit. You know, so I'm on the way to a 2.5 hour gig up toward Indianapolis. We're going to Bloomington. We go to Oldham. Blew out a tire. Didn't have a spare. Had to have a. I lost $200 before I even got to the gig. And knowing that I was going to make $100, I'm still $100 in the hole. Right. You know, so it's like, we're already an hour late for the gig. It's like going, well, this is going to be, you know what? But the thing was, it was never, you know, I have a good job. I know I don't have to worry about it. It was always fun for me.
Sure.
But then it stopped being fun. And that's when I got out. I did eight years of it again. And I was like, when I still have the trailer sitting in my fucking driveway with all the equipment in it, still there. And I'm like going, I just,
I was that guy too. I actually bought, a new section of a PA today. I've always been the guy that owned all the gear or whatever. And I'm really into these acoustic gigs I'm doing again. I love it. It's funny. I often say I'll play someplace like Noblesville in front of 25,000 people. And then the very next night I'll fly home and play in front of 10 people, my little acoustic gig. And I enjoy both just as much, man. I love them both.
Absolutely.
You know? And, but I'm still that guy that buys the gear and hauls it around and sets it up and everything like that. Not in the Brett's band. I have people do it for me in that band.
Yeah. It's a little different there.
Yeah.
I've been that guy. And of course, our other guitar player, our lead guitar player, singer, man, I broke a string last week. Well, I didn't buy new strings, but do you just have another one? Cause I haven't replaced that one.
Right. Right.
You know, my
pain. The worst part is I know who he's talking about. <I know. laughs> Anyway, when you guys were putting this book together, was there anything that kind of caught you off guard or surprised you when you were working on it?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting you say that. There's a couple. I wanted to encompass the top and the bottom of of the music industry. And there was a couple moments that I had to dig down and talk about that were really low points in my life. And I don't think about those times much anymore, but it became very emotional resurfacing some of that stuff and writing about, you know, one of those strangest moments I talk about in my entire career was me and Brett had written a song called Nothing to Lose, and we had Miley Cyrus sing on it with us, with Brett. And I got to produce it. I got to work with Miley in the studio. The song came out great. And during that time, I had gone through a divorce, and me and Brett's friendship had grown, and we'd grown as songwriting partners. So I was riding, me and Brett were riding one bus together, and the rest of the band and crew were riding another bus together. And the band had been my band and my best friends in my life. And they had, some tension had grown because they weren't nearly as involved in the songwriting and recording processes as me and Brett were. Their relationships, I grew farther away from everything I knew in my life and grew closer to Brett and what we were doing. And so the point of that was, they didn't have any writing credits on this song with Miley Cyrus, and it just didn't mean much to them. And we were in Dubuque, Iowa, the day the song was released. And, you know, Brett comes from a world where if your song's a hit, it means it sold a million copies. And he knows the world's not like that anymore, but it's still a culture shock to people that lived through that world, you know? So I'm telling the story wrong. You got to read the book. But the point is, it was a low point in my life, and the song came out, and I was the first to get the report that morning that we were the number one rock song added to radio. And at the same time, Bon Jovi and Nickelback had released a song that same week, and we had beat them, and we had debuted, I think, at number 5 on the Billboard charts, or all this stuff. And it was every single thing I ever wanted in my life had happened. I'm a gigantic Bon Jovi fan, and to think that I did something and was a step ahead of them for even a day, right? And not in a competitive way, like haha, but it just felt good. You know what I mean?
Kind of validating.
I had a hit song. I had written or co-written and produced and played on a real hit song. And me and my wife, it was my ex-wife, it was a terrible time. We weren't even speaking. There was no other relationship really happening in my life. And my drummer, my bass player weren't even really, we just weren't friends anymore. And I woke Brett up, tell him the news. And he goes, oh, all right, that's great. How many copies did it sell? And I don't want to divulge that, but it was significantly less than what he expected for having the top song at radio that week. Right. And he wasn't mad, but he just went back to bed. He didn't share. He wrote Every Rose Has Its Thorn. You know, I was completely alone in a parking lot in the middle of Iowa with every dream I'd ever wanted came true and no one at all to share it with. And I'm literally a grown man. I fall to my knees and just start crying in the tour bus on what was supposed to be the absolute greatest day of my life. And so there's a couple of those stories that I brought up that that were dark and hard to bring up. But I wanted the whole story out there, everything that made me who I am, you know?
Yeah. I was actually reading that one at lunchtime today. Like I said, I was trying to take in as much as I could, and I got to that point, and I felt for you at that point because I did, you know, because you're like, oh my God, look what we've done, and you told Brett, you know, it's like this. And of course, you know, somebody who's wrote so many great songs is like, well, how much did you sell? I was like, well, I don't know. It's just, but we're this way in the charts.
Right.
You know, you're ecstatic. And he's like, oh, it's just.
Right. Well, it's funny. If I don't know if you read enough, but I'm not a sports guy at all. I don't know anything about sports. I've never played sports. But when I was trying to draw the comparison to make sure that everyone understood that Brett was not being a dick. He was happy, but I drew this comparison. I thought was probably my favorite comparison. My favorite thing I did in the book was explaining that it was for Brett. It was like Brett had won the Super Bowl on a 100-yard field with Every Rose Has a Thorn. And it was almost like in the music industry, the game had changed. And now the football field's only 50 yards.
Yeah, exactly.
We'd won the Super Bowl with a whole bunch of different rules, and it didn't feel as big to Brett. We still won the Super Bowl, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And that comparison, I think, made a lot of sense. I was proud of that, considering I don't know anything about sports, but
right.
But you get it. It was, you know, there's a lot of things in the music business. You got to be built for it, man, and you got to be prepared to be alone, even when you're not alone. You know, there's a Bon Jovi song on the Slippery When Wet record called Never Say Goodbye. Mm-hmm. And there's this line that always struck me is I pass my time with strangers, but this bottle's my only friend. And I believe that every one of us that are out there doing this at this level for the length of time that, you know, this is 36 years for me. I've been in Brett's band 20 years, but I've been professional touring artist for 36 years. You find darkness and loneliness, and then you find that crowd cheers, and then it all goes away. You get up on stage and they clap, and then all of a sudden none of that matters. And, you know, you're making people happy, and that there's more value in that than there is gold, man.
I can dig that.
Yeah.
I had a question for you. The you know, during, you were talking about the 90s in the book, and made a reference to a line that I wrote down, actually, when, because I've read most of it. Mm-hmm. Grunge was a fad, but pop is eternal.
Right.
And I thought that was very apropos, really, because you think about, you know, the grunge came in, and everybody's like, grunge came in and killed, you know, rock music for whatever it was worth, and heavy metal and that kind of stuff. But it didn't last very long. And I didn't realize in the timeline, you know, when you had kind of laid the timeline out there about things that were coming out at the time, it really wasn't as long as I thought it was.
It felt like it
hung around forever,
right?
But it really didn't hang around forever. It hung around for a little bit of time, and then it kind of flipped around to being, you know, then pop kind of came along. I mean, that never went away.
Yeah.
Just kind of moved into that thing. But it was just very interesting how you laid that out in the book. I thought it was a pretty cool analogy.
I was just talking about this. The way history rewrites itself is almost as if grunge started on January 1st, 1990. That's the way the world thinks it happened. And in all honesty, you know, I use this as a reference. Poison had Something to Believe In was as big a hit as Every Rose in 1992. So we were 2 years into the 90s. And that stuff was still going strong. You know what I mean? Something to Believe In at the MTV Awards beat Faith No More epic video for Song of the Year that year in 92. It wasn't till 92, 93 that it really, really, the term grunge was taking over. And it was only till about 1998, really, until the Matchbox 20s and the Sugar Rays and the Gin Blossoms and then the Goo Goo Dolls, who all had and Hootie and the Blowfish all had pop songs and fun songs again. It was a really short window of time that the grunge was really there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, when I look back now, and Brett will tell you too, it didn't ruin the music. Grunge didn't. Grunge had to come because it all got to a point.
It cleansed everything.
It cleansed. You know, rock and roll is meant to be raw, and then you want to be better, and then you want to be polished, and it's this process. And you know, I'll give you an example. I think that happens is, you know, I'll start with the Beatles, but I'm going to say the Beatles, and I'm going to say Kiss, and I'm going to say Van Halen, and I'm going to say Bon Jovi, and I'm going to say Poison, and there's a million other bands, but these examples in my life we grew with them.
Right.
The first records were terrible. The second records are better. I mean, I'm a giant Van Halen fan, and you can't – I mean, I have the Van Halen tattoo on this arm. And, yes, Van Halen 1 changed the fucking world, and I live – am I allowed to say the F word? Or that,
yeah, sure, say whatever you want.
We're unedited. Censored. It's one of the
uncensored.
Uncensored, unedited, whatever.
The Van Halen record changed the world with it did. But it still was raw. It was underproduced. And then Van Halen 2 was a step better. You know, look what the cat dragged in. And Motley Crue, the first Motley Crue record, terrible sounding records with a lot of youthful energy and a lot of great songs. But, you know, open up and say, I came out with Poison. That record was much better. All those bands, you grow at the beginning of something, you grew with something. And then at the end of the 80s, and God bless this example because it hurts my heart because Bill Everett is one of my best friends of all time. But that first Firehouse record already sounded like they were as good as they were ever going to be. There was nowhere to grow. That record was produced flawlessly. The playing and the singing on it was flawless. So their next record just sounded like a continuation. There was no growth. And I think that happens. And then all of a sudden, all these bands and the technology and the songwriting and everything became so similar and so generic that it had to reinvent itself. It has to. And that's what happened with grunge. And I would bet my life that we're seeing it in country music right now. Country music is polished and pop as it gets. And then this Oliver Anthony guy comes. And are you familiar with who he is?
I know who he is. Yeah, I know who he is. He's a new guy. He's like taking over everything.
But it's grunge.
It's grunge. It is. It's very dirty, dirty country.
It's as raw as it gets. It's grunge for country, man. And I believe we're about to see that whole movement happen again.
Grunge country.
They're not going to call it grunge country, though. They're going to call it some kind of outlaw country.
Dirty country.
Well, that guy, Oliver Anthony.
I don't know what his name is, but
he's from Virginia. He's from just a few hours from where I am, but he's right in that part of the country that is considered Appalachian.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And much like Seattle was this beat down poor thing, you can go on YouTube now and there's an entire movement of that Appalachian lifestyle. Just like the grunge thing was a lifestyle. It wasn't just music. It had
clothes and everything else.
Everything. Yeah. And I believe that we're about to see it in the country.
And if you want to be cool, it's actually Appalachian.
I can't say it. I know you're correct.
I'm big time. I spent a lot of time in West Virginia and always called it Appalachian and like going, you can't do that. If you're from here, it's Appalachian.
Right. So my father was born in Bluefield, West Virginia. Was right
there. You go. I used to work in Bluefield. So
did you really?
Oh yeah. He used to work down there in Bluefield and all that area. Yeah.
But my whole life I've said Appalachian, and I know it's not. But my point is, there's a whole movement about that lifestyle right now, and I believe that's what we're about to usher in as the new kind of grunge thing.
Isn't it kind of cool?
Yeah. So it'll be great. It'll be great. Everything needs a change. You know, I just didn't connect with the grunge stuff. I look back now, and I'm very aware of what Kurt Cobain did. He changed history. I get it. You know, I don't love it, but I understand what he did. And I understand that he spoke to millions of people, but I didn't get it. And I was happy when 97, 98 rolled around. And I know he's my friend. So I bring Mark McGrath a lot because he's my friend, but they were fun songs again. The Mark McGrath stuff and the Smash Mouth and the, I was a giant Hootie and the Blowfish fan because they were from basically my parts, you know. The one thing I didn't get, even though he's a Virginia boy, is I had a hard time understanding Dave Matthews when that came out.
Oh, we hate who? Dave Matthews.
I don't even know who you're talking about. Never heard of him.
Yeah.
Wait, you haven't watched our show, have you, Pete? Because we slam Dave Matthews all the time. He sucks.
So to be honest with you, I've not watched your show, but just spending a few minutes with you guys after I eat dinner tonight, I'm probably going to do as much research on you guys as I can.
We got 360 something shows you can watch, and we will.
After he watches a few of our episodes, he's going to call Dave Tedder and say, "Don't publish that episode."
No, not at all. I'm having a great time with it. I hope you guys are. But
we always.
Here's the other thing, though, Pete, that I took from your book that I thought was really funny, it was a fact of when you were getting your bands together and you had, and I've been through this where you got everybody's on key and all this bullshit and you were into Poison and all that stuff. And then Queensbryche came out.
That was a hard day for me, man.
That I was reading it. I was like, I was just laughing my butt off because I've been through that. And you got these guys that we're all on track. This is kind of the band we're going to be. And then somebody finds this new band that, you know, I can't freaking stand. Not that I don't like Queensrÿche, but I'm not a, you know, it, but it's one of those things where I understand that. And it's like going, holy shit. It's always a bad day.
You know, what's interesting is I live my life. I teach and I preach perspective is everything. Right.
Sure.
But I have to tell you, one of the greatest slaps in the face I ever got in my life, I don't tell this story in the book, was from Jeff Tate himself.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. So please,
it's a Tate thing.
He put me in my place like no one's ever put me in my place before. So his band opened up for us in Ohio. Where was it at? There was a big rock festival in Ohio maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Rock on the Range.
Rock on the Range was at it. It was totally muddy, terrible. It was a disaster.
That sounds like it.
Yeah. And Queensrÿche was opening for us. And I went up and I said, Jeff, I got to tell you something. I said, you're probably not going to find this funny, but it's interesting that you're here. And I would love to tell you that you ruined my high school band. And if you read the book, you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about.
And he's looking at me. And I don't know if you ever met him. He's super dry, guy. Nice, kind, super dry. And I said, I told him the whole story that unfolds in the book. And he looked at me and he goes, so I ruined your band. Maybe Brett ruined the band, because which was true. I never put it in that perspective. My guys were fucked because I liked Poison, but I was fucked because they like, and Jeff put me in my place, man. And we laughed and he gave me a big hug, but he was right about it. And then, but he told
That's
me,
funny.
He told me it was a great story. And then, and he was awesome. He was nice, but yeah, that Queensrÿche thing changed, set me on a different projectile. My life changed.
You know, and the thing is, anybody who's ever played guitar, ever tried to get a band together in high school will love your book. Because right. it will, there's so many stories in there that are so similar to the ones that I had. I'm sure the ones that Alan had, Bill didn't, because Bill was never in a band. But
so you have more money than the rest of us and you don't have to see a therapist, right?
That's right. But anyway, no, but I do. I enjoy. And like I said, that's why I said I want to buy the book. I've been trying to read it on my iPhone and on my iPad.
Yeah, right.
We're going to let you know, put your book out here in a little bit. But no, I really loved reading what I wrote or what I read. Not what I wrote, what I read.
I appreciate it, man.
Just so you know, he's big into plagiarism, so you might want to check it out.
Hey,
I think I'm going to write a book next week. I'm going to write a book.
What is the term? Imitation is the best form of flattery, right?
There you go.
I would tell any of you guys, I've spent 36 years in the music industry. I've done everything I ever dreamed of and more. Like I said, sometimes I look at my phone and I'm like, I have a text from Ace Frehley or D. Snyder, and it doesn't even make sense to me sometimes. But the reward of writing a book trumps all of that. If you've got that in you, do it. There is something to be said for having that. I can't explain it. It's something I never wanted to do. I never cared about doing. And then I wrote the first one almost as therapy for myself. And I love it. And if you've got a story to tell, man, you say you have the same stories as me. And I believe you do, because that's why I wrote that book. You should write it. Even if only 100 people ever read it.
We had a demo recording. Our drummer went to the Marines and or whatever, Navy, whatever it was. And he went to, and he met somebody that was with, what was the one that Ace Frehley, I can't even think of the record company that took Ace Frehley at first.
Megaforce.
Yeah. He got the guy from Eddie Trunk. I know all. He met the guy and he said, if you can come to Michigan and reproduce this song and do two more, we'll sign you. Mm-hmm. And he called us and I was 3 months from graduating college. And I said, I can't do it.
Oh boy. Yeah. You're smart.
There you go.
You're smart. My son has decided he wants to be in the music business and it's, you know, I can't tell him no. My entire life is this, you know,
right.
And he's got a great head start. You know, Tom Kiefer has mentored him. Brett talks to him all the time. Ted Poley and Steve Brown and all these guys, we're all helping him. Eric Brittingham and Dana Strum and everybody's rooting for him. But I still don't want him to feel this pain, man. I don't want him to feel it. And then the worst part about that is I'm thinking, well, my youngest son will do something else. My youngest son won't be into music. So it turns out he wants to be an MMA fighter. That's fucking worse. Even when you're winning, you're getting your ass beat. I don't want to watch my kid get his ass beat the rest of his life.
Short-lived career.
Right. You should give him a Les Paul and say, here, son, I've tried,
but you know, sometimes when I'm out in LA with Brett, we go out to the shooting range and, Chuck Liddell is out there. Do you know who he is?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Chuck Liddell. I know exactly who he is.
I mean, he's a grappler.
He's a grappler guy, right?
Yeah, he's like the Tony
MMA, Hawk. But you know,
he's the Tony Hawk of that cage fighting thing, or you know what I mean. And sometimes he can't even speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's had his ass kicked so much. Do you know what I'm saying? And like, you know, and Leon Spinks comes out every time we're in Vegas. Leon Spinks comes out to see us play. His wife loves Brett, and comes out to see us play. And the guy doesn't even know where he is half the time from having his ass beat. It's like,
get your bell rung enough.
Yeah.
I'd rather him be in a rock band.
Yeah. There you go. It's like either drugs or getting your head beat so many times. It's what's going to happen. Yeah. You know, it's not good either way. So,
right on.
Well, Pete, tell our listeners where they can find your book and where they can find you.
So Amazon.com is where the book is. To be honest with you, man, I don't know any of my social media handles. I just know that just go to any of them and type my name and it pops up. But I don't know what they all actually are. There's an underscore here or a hyphen there or this or that, whatever I had to do to make them. But if you type my name, Pete Evick, on any of the social media platforms, something will come up and you can follow me. And I would be grateful to anyone that followed me on at least Instagram or Facebook.
Right on. And for anybody that's wondering, his last name is spelled E-V-I-C-K. And on that note, thank you for being on the show. Hang tight for a second as I take us out of here. Visit agesofrock.com. Check out our past episodes and social media links. And until next time, peace out.